is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The G7 just concluded in Japan, Hiroshima, Japan. And the summary, this is German media reporting, during talks in the Japanese city of Hiroshima, the leaders of the G7 vowed, quote, to stand together against Russia's illegal, unjustifiable, and unprovoked war of aggression against Ukraine. And their photographs showing the leaders sitting at a table with smiles and working in a fashion that is extremely encouraging. And I welcome Mary Kissel, the executive vice president of Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State, who attended, she tells me, a G20. So the ambiance of these meetings are unknown to me. All I ever get is the press releases. Mary, this is leaders of the G7, which is the core of the G20. Are these moments genuine meeting conversations? Because I get the sense that everything is very carefully scripted. What is the possibility of spontaneity in these meetings? Good evening to you, Mary.
Good evening, John. The answer is yes, most of these meetings are heavily scripted, but that doesn't mean that they can't produce some significant outcomes. And it's interesting to see these leaders, recall the G7 is the U.S. and Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and us. When I was at the trilateral meeting, one of the trilateral meetings between the U.S., South Korea, and Japan just a few years ago, it was a very polite but a very frosty affair. And you contrast that with the scenes from the G7 with Japanese Prime Minister Kishida very warmly hosting his counterparts, serving a very energetic role in foreign policy, making strong statements, not just on Russia, John, but also on China, where the members agreed to, quote, coordinate on preventing cutting-edge technologies from being used to further what they called military capabilities that threaten international peace and security. I mean, essentially what you're seeing is these nations mugged by reality.
The G7 conversation turned on Ukraine, certainly. That was a major talking point. So it also turned on China. Russia first. Striking to me was a photograph that appeared in the Financial Times during the meeting. The president of Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky, had been invited and everyone had agreed. And I believe he flew there in a French airplane. Mr. Macron made it available to him. But he was speaking not with Macron. He was speaking with the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, who is very popular, very powerful, and not a member of G7, but certainly a participant in world affairs. I was struck by the photo because we know that India is, the polite term is fence-sitting on the Ukraine conflict. Mary, your measure of India, where is it in the world of affairs? It's got the most people on earth. That makes you number one. Great promise for development, but where is it in geopolitical affairs of a crisis like Ukraine?
Well, India has long tried to stand apart and to be, quote-unquote, non-aligned. It was non-aligned in the Cold War, and it's trying very hard to be non-aligned as the world divides back up into blocks, a U.S.-led block and a China-led block. But that's understandable. New Delhi physically, geographically, sits in between China and Russia. These two nations are cooperating. They're both nuclear states, as is India. And so there's no question that Modi, I think, has an affection for the West. He understands that his voters have an affection for the West. There's no love lost between the Indian people and the Chinese Communist Party. But he feels that he has to tread carefully. But I thought it was interesting, John, just to go back to the G7 theme, to see Prime Minister Kishida invite Ukraine's Zelensky to participate and to meet with people like Modi. Again, it just shows the renewed energy in Japan's diplomacy, which is really a welcome thing. And it's not one-off. As we've talked about in prior shows, Kishida has done a lot to calm tensions with his South Korean counterpart. He's hosted the German chancellor. He's forging new ties with Vietnam, very close ties with India. He said he's open to a NATO liaison office in Japan. And so from that point of view, it's really not surprising that Japan hosting the G7 in Hiroshima would produce some significant rhetorical shows of support for Ukraine, but also some action via sanctions and a new kind of initiative to combat China's economic coercion. So I thought it was an important meeting.
The Russian component here is the war, the act of war, and what is to be done going forward. I did not see a note of diplomacy in the statement about Russia, unless you read it between the lines, Mary. It would appear that the G7 going forward is going to continue to contribute weapons systems to Ukraine and to support Mr. Zelensky on the battlefield. Did that surprise you that the G7 was partly a military council?
No, because, again, the G7 has been mugged by reality. These are democracies, and they know that it's simply a political nightmare for them if they even tried to suggest that, you know, we should go easy on Putin as his military and irregular forces rampage over Ukraine, attacking not just the Ukrainian military, but, you know, women and children and committing war crimes. The war, too, recall, has had some significant economic impacts, forcing the reshuffling of energy supply lines to continental Europe. Japan, remember, is extremely dependent on imported oil. So, you know, it's in their interest to have the war settled as soon as possible, and it's clear that diplomacy isn't going to do it. Macron has frankly embarrassed himself, I think, by trying to get a totalitarian state in China, which is Russia's ally, to somehow intervene. That's ridiculous. And the G7, I think, has signaled that they're on the side of right, and they will stick together. And the question really, John, to my mind, is will they provide Ukraine the weapons that they need either to force a Russian withdrawal or to force Russia to the negotiating table or both? And the answer to that is that, you know, not yet. We see some signs, particularly with the discussion of the provision of F-16 aircraft to Ukraine. But the G7 would have to do a lot more to squeeze Russia economically on the sanctions side while they provide aid, intelligence, and weapons to the Ukrainian side.
Some of the contradictions we saw right at the close of the G7, the President of the United States made remarks about the G7 and then talked about China using the word thaw, the way the New York Times reported it. It was easy to miss Mr. Biden's prediction on Sunday of a coming thaw in relations with Beijing, as both sides move beyond what he called the silly Chinese act of sending a giant surveillance balloon over the U.S., only the most recent in a series of incidents that have fueled what seems like a descent toward confrontation. This is the New York Times, Peter Baker and David Sanger, senior correspondents. The reason I mention this, Mary, is because immediately afterwards, we had two things happen. One, China announced the embargo, the blockage, the punishment of the U.S. by blocking Micron technology chips into its business model and accelerating everybody's anxiety about a trade war. And two, Russia sent a senior executive, I think the most senior, to visit Beijing since the beginning of the war, to sign what is seen as a long-term trade deal between Beijing and Moscow. There's a puzzle here, Mary. Is China with Beijing, or is China with the G7? Is China looking to thaw, or is China looking to confront?
Well, I think you mean China, is China with Russia? And the answer is clearly yes. Moscow sent the Prime Minister Mnuchin, I believe, to Beijing, and he made some comments while he was there. He said relations between the two nations were at a, quote, unprecedented high level. There have been multiple meetings between Xi Jinping and Putin, and they're clearly cooperating across the defense sphere, the economic sphere, the diplomatic sphere. So that's very clear. As for China's actions toward the United States and also the G7, they see President Biden essentially, I don't want to say begging, that's not the right word, but asking repeatedly for talks and to calm tensions, and that's a sign of weakness. And so to make their position very clear, they're humiliating the U.S. president by taking action against a U.S. company, in this case, Micron, $72 billion market cap company. It's not a small operator. And banning certain Chinese companies from buying Micron chips. And in doing so, they accomplish two things. They don't just humiliate the president, who wants better ties, but they try to create a wedge between the United States and some of our partners like South Korea, who have competing chip makers that sell into China, companies like Samsung or SK Hynix. So I think President Biden has really bent over backwards. We haven't seen an FBI report released on the spy balloon and what they were looking at and what they were doing and how often this has happened. You've seen not just economic attacks on Micron, but also on Bain & Company in Shanghai. We still have Chinese Americans who are detained in the mainland. You have democracy advocates like Hong Kong's Jimmy Lai, who is a British citizen but has many supporters, including myself, in the United States and in the U.S. Congress, just detained arbitrarily, likely, probably, unfortunately, for the rest of his life on trumped-up charges. I mean, they're just trying to humiliate Washington as much as they can. And I think the Biden softening is unfortunate. I think there are people within the National Security Council right now who disagree with this policy and want to be tougher and not to go to the negotiating table without China giving something up for that privilege. But the president sets U.S. foreign policy, and this is clearly President Biden's preference. I just think he's taking a gamble, because if history is any guide, when the United States goes soft on China, China simply presses onward and punches us in the face even more. So if your reaction is to say, gosh, you've punched me in the face, that really hurt, don't do it again, and then they do it again and you do nothing, well, it's obvious who the dominant power is, and it only encourages more aggressiveness from Beijing.
Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State. We're going to turn to China. Mary was many years in Hong Kong for the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. I've recently learned a deal about the Belt and Road Initiative that is entirely Xi Jinping's policy, and it's in trouble. What does it mean about China's ability to punch anyone? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm